There's a human story behind all the nuclear bluster we hear out of North Korea, but it's not an easy one to tell. When writer Adam Johnson set out to tell it, he used fiction as his vehicle. The result was his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Orphan Master's Son, his account of life inside what Johnson calls the most voiceless place in the world, the ongoing cruel psychological experiment that is today's North Korea. Johnson's in town for an author's talk this evening in Honolulu. We spoke with him last week about the difficulty of sorting fact from fiction in Kim Jong-un's world.
The North Koreans are very bellicose with their threats and with the way they discuss things. One of the tricky things with dealing with North Korea is the fact that they have a single voice. It's a challenge to determine the audience. With a single voice, they speak to the people of North Korea, to the people of Pyongyang, to South Korea, to the region, to the world. And it's hard to disambiguate those.
And you have no alternative voice to compare.
That's absolutely true. In America, we have many different spokespersons. They speak in different forums. They alter their speech. They customize things. They say who they're speaking to, but
right. That's
not how the North Koreans do business.
Well, there's a whole, it's a cottage industry dissecting the nuances of statements from North Korea's leaders over the years.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I think they get a lot out of being cryptic.
Mm-hmm.
But, they're a tiny country. They're a very impoverished country. And yet, through a series of techniques like crypto communication, they've managed to be at the center of international conversations.
Yeah, having an impact out of all proportion to their size or population.
It's really an astonishing case study in that regard.
There's a pretty sophisticated understanding of how people think, how they react, how news media react. This is not random stuff, is it?
Well, it's difficult to cover North Korea and to talk about North Korea because, in the West, in the world of journalism, we have certain standards. Quotes have to be able to be confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
Facts have to be verifiable. You have to be able to research the place. And none of that is true for North Korea.
Yeah.
We can verify nothing.
Yeah.
And really all we have about the place are satellite photos and the testimonies of defectors, which are come from people who are traumatized, who probably only see a certain sector of North Korea. And the picture can only be made in aggregate. But as a novelist, I felt like I had an edge on journalism in some regards. What the journalist cannot use is rumor, suspicion, nightmare, dream, fantasy. But to me, as a novelist, those are all very useful to help make a portrait of the psychology there.
Well, thinking back of my own days in journalism, there are always things in the newsroom that darn well to be true that you can't report. But know that's true, and that's where fiction has an advantage. That's exactly the response I had to your work, that you were using fiction to reveal to a nonfiction purpose in a number of ways.
Well, I also personally believe that all humans have the same sets of desires and needs, that we're all fundamentally the same. When you talk to a defector, certainly they have had experiences that I've never had, but what startles you is how much you have in common. They want the same things in life.
Mm-hmm.
Safety, security, opportunity, better future for their kids. All of these things are there. And if this is a place where people cannot get their humanity out, they can't create, they can't report, they can't articulate anything to the outside world, I kind of felt like maybe it was possible to project our humanity in if we do have an essential commonality.
Even in the most appalling stories of human suffering, humanity has a way of kind of shining through, doesn't it?
It does. And in appalling circumstances are opportunities for, like, altruism, sacrifice, and definition of humanity to come into a sharper focus than in normal life. And that terrain for a novelist, getting your characters to a place where they kind of must define themselves, is a place where you're going to make the richest human portraits.
Well, you know, what happens to the human spirit when it's crushed, or at least attempts are made to crush it? How does life somehow emerge through that?
Well, it is certainly definitive. You know, one thing I think about North Korea is this. You know, we like in the West what I call the Sophie's Choice story, where humans have to make impossible decisions. And maybe once in your life you have to make one, or maybe not at all. But I do feel like everyone in North Korea is faced with a Sophie's Choice, something impossible. Do I feed this child and not that child? Do I report on this person? Do I allow myself to be reported on? Do I make a stand and sacrifice everything or not? And so, it's a place where I believe there is a clear line between surviving and living. And, you know, in the West, we like to think of living as meaning having a meaningful life.
Yeah.
You know, something that's of your own identity and spirit. And sometimes there you have to choose.
Well, I would think so, and I would also think that given that the conditions that you describe have now been going on for generations, that there are people of age today who have never grown up in any other world except one defined by paranoia.
That's right. You know, here's, books mean a lot to us in the Western world. They certainly mean a lot to me. If you think about the fact that the Japanese began the colonial period by invading the Korean Peninsula in 1910, and when they do that, they make Korean art illegal, like the gaegeum and taegeum, like national instruments, became illegal. They began instruction in the schools in Japanese. Koreans had to take on Japanese names. Japanese or Korean theater became forbidden, and Korean books. And so starting in 1910, Korean books become inaccessible to Koreans. And in North Korea, you know, you have the colonial period, World War II, partition by the superpowers, you have the Civil War, and then in the North, more than six decades of a propagandistic regime where novels are illegal. And so in that place, no one has read a novel, as you and I would think of it, in over 100 years. And so your great-grandparent doesn't remember anyone who's read a book as we would know it.
Yeah. A complete overhaul of human consciousness for a society, I would think.
And what does it mean to be so divorced from your own identity, from your own Koreanness? 4,000 years of Koreanness have been erased by the Kim regime. And we won't really know what that, you know, means until, of course, the regime's gone and people are free to ask questions.
Your research for your novel, based in large part on defector testimony and on your own experience, but how difficult was it for you as a Westerner to get inside this admittedly extremely foreign mindset?
Well, I did travel to North Korea. I traveled there when Kim Jong-il was still in power. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know much more about Kim Jong-il than I have a sense of maybe Kim Jong-un. But Kim Jong-il loved money. He needed money, and he loved tourism. And he was a very kind of cunning, savvy person, and he had a very controlled way of bringing tourists in. It was difficult for me to go. You have to think of this place as like, there's no rule of law, and there are no institutions other than the whim of the dictator. And so if he says, hey, let's bring some tourists in and get some cash, well, then tourist season's open. And then the next year, no tourists. So you kind of just, it's catch as catch can there. But, you know, Kim Jong-un, you know, I can't really figure him out from my perspective. You know, I don't have a security clearance. But, you know, why imprison tourists? You know, that cost him so much money.
Yeah.
Why close the Kaesong Industrial Complex? That cost him $1 million a day. So I can't figure out his self-interest necessarily.
It's too easy to dismiss this as craziness, isn't it?
Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, it's so difficult to report on North Korea. It takes long, intensive portraits with tons of research. So it's easier for people to just say, oh, it's a place of madness, of evil or buffoonery. You know, we have these shorthand portraits.
Yeah.
Really, it's a place where 24 million people were unlucky enough to be born into. They're just as smart and funny and human and feeling and caring as we are. Yet they're just trapped under, like, a regime that's created the cruelest psychological experiment, like, ever dreamed up.
This is exactly where fiction can tell a story that nonfiction can only approach, isn't it?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, I just became interested as a curious reader. I read a memoir of a defector, and it made me ask questions like, you know, I'm a father. I wondered what it would be like to be a dad there. And I'm a writer. I wondered what would I have to write there. And as I went looking for portraits of normal life in North Korea, I found them exceedingly rare. And I really think that for the people who make it out of North Korea, first of all, they're traumatized. And their stories, you know, don't come easily. They have survivor's guilt. The people who are left behind pay the price for their freedom. I think people who make it out often just want to look forward and not dwell on the past. They want new stories. And there's a lot of reasons why they don't tend to tell their stories. And I just was surprised at how hard it was to find portraits of, like, how people fall in love there, you know, what they have for breakfast.
Yeah.
And so I wondered if, even though I'm, like, a white guy from California, and I'm not Korean, I asked myself many times, what am I doing writing this story? I also asked many times, like, why aren't more people trying to give voice to, like, the most voiceless place in the world?
Adam Johnson will speak this evening at a Books and Spirits event at Revolution Smart Home on Ward Avenue in Honolulu.